agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Hey, Jay, how are you doing this week?
Well, it's been a busy week. I'm about as overwhelmed as the Martha's Vineyard Visitor Center. So good to be here.
Yeah. Some of you may have expected Trey and Ken, because in fact, last week I said Trey and Ken would be doing the show. So we hope you're not too disappointed. Trey's a little bit under the weather, doing better, but Jay and I jumped in so we could fill this slot. And so
and we bust him to Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah, absolutely. So anyway, we do have a lot to talk about. Of course, that we mentioned that DeSantis is flying first class,
I
you know,
spoke,
chartering but... flights anyway. But that and updates on the Trump search case and the August inflation report and Lindsey Graham's interesting decision to introduce a national abortion ban legislation, maybe some stuff about Russia, China, and the U.S., Ukrainian offensive, all sorts of things, and we are going to get going with it in just 1 minute. So, Jay, before we get started, I just wanted to mention our book club feature, which we're going to begin not this week, but the week following, which would be September 27th. And the book we're starting with on the Supporter Bonus Show is Everything, All the Time, Everywhere, How We Became Postmodern by Stuart Jeffries. And there's actually a really interesting interview with him on Vox Conversations a little while back that I heard. Definitely worth checking out if you're interested. So that, again, will start on the bonus show on the 27th, and then we'll kind of be working our way through the book from that point on. If you're interested in following along, getting a link to the book and kind of knowing what we're doing, when we're doing it, you can check that out on the Discord feature, which is available to all of our supporters. We'll start today with more developments this week concerning the FBI search of Donald Trump's home and office. Judge Eileen Cannon named a special master to review the documents seized by the FBI, as well as denying the Justice Department's motion for a partial stay of her September 5th order, which enjoined the government from using the documents they took from Trump in their ongoing investigation. And the government is appealing the denial of the stay to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, as well as, I believe, filing a separate appeal of Cannon's September 5th decision in its entirety. Now, the special master named is Senior U.S. District Judge Raymond Deary. The 78-year-old was first nominated for the bench by Ronald Reagan in 1986, and he took senior status in 2011. The Justice Department wrote in a recent filing that Deary has substantial judicial experience, including federal cases involving national security, which in fact included a 7-year term on the U.S. FISA, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. And as you might expect from a candidate who was deemed acceptable by both sides, he has a reputation for integrity and impartiality. A Cannon ordered the special masters to aim for a November 30th completion date, and that's a lot longer than the DOJ was hoping for. They wanted to see this wrapped up, hoping by early October, but it's slightly faster than what the Trump team wanted. So, Jay, what's your take on these latest developments here?
So, I think it's a positive sign that everyone was able to agree on a special master, to the extent that they agreed that one should be appointed in the first place. He certainly seems to be qualified and would be the type of person that you would hope to have assigned as a special master on this type of case. Although I say this type of case, there's really no other type of case like this ever.
Yeah.
I think that's all well and good. My sense is the judge's order to have it done by November is that's an outside date. I would expect that he would be moving with all alacrity to get it done beforehand. On the Department of Justice appeal, I get that. I think there's institutional turf to protect, right? In order to make sure that, you know, down the road, not every Tom, Dick, and Harry embezzler or drug dealer you know, starts demanding a special master. Right. I think they, you know, that's why they have to appeal it. And this will be the special, seek this, the stay, the, with allowing the, review of certain documents. That's a little more curious to me. And again, it's one of those things we don't know. Supposedly Justice Department is saying there's 100 key documents that they need to be able to review, which to me strikes me as, well, if you know there's 100 that they're key, that, you know, well, then you've already reviewed them.
Right.
At least in part, right?
Well, I think they mentioned, didn't they, that part of their argument initially was that their team that they set up to look through the documents actually had gone through pretty much everything. So, yeah.
So that's a little strange. And again, I'm in a position, well, as we all are, that it's tough to make arguments or judgments about this when we don't know what we don't know. My concern is there would be certainly the appearance that the government is seeking to rush this. Maybe there is something, imminent that needs to happen, that these need to be reviewed right away. But I'm not persuaded yet. And again, it may be impossible for me to be persuaded, given the limitations of what the government can disclose.
Right. I think,
to the public, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, it seems to me like we can't count on this review being done by early December, because I would expect that, given that both the Department of Justice and Trump's attorneys will be able to object to the judge's or Deary's special master's decision on how he rules on certain documents, and then those have to go actually to the judge herself, then I can see the Trump folks definitely wanting to spring this out and potentially this going, into 2023. And if you're of a more cynical or conspiratorial mindset, you would say, well, this gives Trump's team greater opportunity, right, to conceal, destroy, or in other ways kind of impede this investigation. And that's, we don't know what we don't know, but it seems to me that would likely be, if the Justice Department has a legitimate concern, that would be their legitimate concern.
Yeah, although they already have, let's put it this way, they already have the documents, or at least a whole lot of documents.
Right. They just can't use
and them. As we pointed out like last week, if it's just dawning on the Trump team right now, oh, geez, we need to get rid of some of that stuff. Well, wow, they're, they're sort of behind the
less competent than we thought. Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, certainly Trump has gone through all the good attorneys almost at this point, and he has to sort of scrape the, at least the middle of the barrel to get legal counsel, it seems, at this point. But then, it also seems to me that even if the 11th Circuit ruling on the DOJ's appeal is entirely favorable, I would expect Trump's folks to appeal to the Supreme Court. And my guess would be that the Supreme Court, before they could issue any kind of ruling, would keep Judge Cannon's initial injunction in place. And so that would mean, I would expect, even if things go entirely Department of Justice's way, it would be probably, months before actually they could use those documents. And it probably will actually be quicker to just wait for the special master to get through kind of going through stuff, would be my sense.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's right.
So, yeah, anything else on this that occurs to you, or?
Well, again, it's one of these weird stories where, what I struggle with is I have developed a distrust of the, the FBI in these types of situations.
Well, sure, you're reading all that conservative media, and it's telling you the FBI needs to be defunded, and that's you're on the Ted Cruz train. I don't know.
I'm reading the text messages between FBI officials and plea agreements where they admit to fudging national security documents. So in order to get a warrant. So, I mean, I have a distrust going forward. If this was something else, someone else, I think I'd probably feel differently.
What do you say?
The other thing that again, that I'm not in the position to know about is, the, as we spoke before, and I think as Bill Barr had said, this is in many ways a speed bump, right? And to my lights, when you've got something that is this big, that there are questions of either extreme significant criminal wrongdoing by the executive or slash former executive, depending on when you say this happened, and up against questions of legitimacy of the FBI and a investigation, I would think that prudence dictates that you take it slow, right? And slow, transparent, all that. That said, maybe there is some reason why this needs to happen right away, but I'm not, and the general public isn't privy to it. And that's difficult, right? It's difficult to make a judgment in those situations where you've got someone saying, listen, we really, really, really need to see this stuff, and we really, really need to see it right away. But that's also somebody who has not a great track record.
Well, let me ask you about that. I wanted to, because you're talking about, you know, the whatever corruption within the FBI. And I'm wondering to what extent, because, you know, a lot of times, like, for instance, I don't know, with rioters in Charlottesville or January 6th folks or something like that, you hear the argument from the right that, well, you know, there are some bad apples, but in general, these are good people who have legitimate concerns and are just kind of doing their thing. And I'm wondering if that's what that same logic should be applied to, say, the FBI or any large organization where you're almost certainly going to find a few people who are, in fact, corrupt and have bad motives. But that, is it fair to say that the FBI as an organization is corrupt and untrustworthy just because you can, like, again, I would say within any large organization, point to instances in which, yes, it has done things that are just objectively wrong. And I wanted to get your take on that, because especially it seems to me, you know, for instance, when Bill Barr was attorney general, I get the sense that you had, you know, quite a bit of respect for his probity, his integrity, and so forth. And I'm wondering if you extend that same thing to Merrick Garland, and to what extent this might be, you might perhaps be pulled in a certain direction ideologically on this.
So as far as the FBI, and I think I'd like to draw sort of a dotted line, I guess, dashed line between the FBI and Justice Department. The FBI is a subsidiary, as it were, of sure, the Justice Department. I would say, yeah, I think I think most Republicans have been consistent about this, that the issue is not the many, many FBI agents in the field who put their lives on the line and do a great job protecting us against all sorts of crime. I think that's right. I think the concern is that there is a small group of people at the FBI headquarters who have seemed to have been obsessed with political stuff and politics and getting involved. There was a interesting piece in the Wall Street Journal last week talking about institutional changes that Mueller had made after 9/11. The gist was it was really interesting because it wasn't necessarily a partisan thing, right? It was talking about how after 9/11 there was this shift towards more centralization, more focus in Washington a smaller group of people heading stuff up and as opposed to the prior model, which had been sort of a stuff bubbled up from the various offices, right? Your whatever local, you know, Cincinnati, New York, or, you know, wherever, would be in charge. And Washington was not necessarily directing stuff, but that in the wake of that, and this was in some cases suggested because Mueller came under criticism from President Bush after 9/11, there was this attempt at greater centralization, greater compartmentalization in Washington. So I think that's there's an institutional issue there too. So I'm certainly not suggesting that the FBI writ large is corrupt, but if you look at the history of these couple key players early in the Trump administration and a Michael Flynn, you know, interview where you had FBI agents saying, listen, they're probably not expecting us. They're probably not ready. We won't tell them this is a real interview. I mean, this sort of, you know, get Trump and the plan B texts and so forth. And I think it's reasonable to say that this group that is driving this particular investigation of President Trump is, you know, I'm not going to give them the benefit of the doubt that I would if this was a drug investigation, you know, out of the Bismarck, North Dakota office or something.
Got it. Okay. And I wanted to bring that up because I think it's important to make a distinction between people who are raising what I would consider to be legitimate, even if I, you know, don't necessarily agree all the way, concerns about structure and motives and so forth, as opposed to people who talk about the corrupt FBI and the corrupt Justice Department led by the evil Merrick Garland.
Something else the article talked about was the idea that, you know, before there what used to be the typical transition and promotion was from within, and you'd have people who were field agents kind of rising through the ranks to, and it after 9/11, you had a lot more of these other places populated by people who were, I don't want to say political appointees because they would have been still, you know, civil service. But people who did not come necessarily through the law enforcement background.
Right.
So that's, again, it was an interesting article. As far as Merrick Garland goes, I would tend to give, attorneys general, the benefit of the doubt, on these types of things, except Merrick Garland's done some things that I think are really troubling. Mostly the memo last year about, you know, investigating parents who are, you know, raising trouble at school board meetings. To me, that strikes me. And look, this was no doubt this came from the White House, that Department of Education business. He's shown himself to be a political actor, and attorney generals are political actors. I mean, let's be honest. So I think there's that issue. And also the fact that you've had Biden seem to be pushing, right, almost for a investigation and for Garland to do something about Trump. The third piece, and this kind of goes to the FBI and to Garland, is there's the notable silence on other investigations. So
as to the Biden pushing thing, I feel like the administration, especially in comparison to the previous administration, has been quite restrained. And I can't recall any sort of overt calls to investigate Donald Trump. I think they've gone out of their way in the Biden administration to not have a position, a stated position on this. Now, you know, certainly President Biden has said that Donald Trump and MAGA Republicans are a threat to democracy, but it's not right. Like hand locked him up.
That's not their stated position.
So, but that's different than chanting lock him up or lock her up or something like that. And I think so I would disagree with you about the Biden administration calling for that, because I don't see that that's
maybe calling is not appropriate, but I hate the term dog whistling.
Well, I mean, I would think they have to say something. They're not saying anything specifically about the case, but if you believe that a political actor is a threat to democracy, you just can't say, I can't say anything about that. I mean, I think that would, you know, I disagree with you on that. All right, moving on. The August inflation report came out this week. The headline number, a rise of 8.3% from August of 2021, represents a continuing trend of lower inflation, down from 8.5% in July, which in itself was down from 9.1% in June. But the decline was less than a lot of folks expected, and markets dropped pretty significantly on the release of the report. And I think the main reason for concern here is that even with gasoline prices declining, down 10.6% from July to August, inflation in other areas remains a pretty significant problem. And core inflation, that is inflation for all items excluding those typically more volatile food and energy sectors, was 6.3% in August, which actually is an increase from the 5.9% rate from July and June, and actually the highest core inflation since March is 6.5%. And so to kind of put this in real world terms, the average household is spending around $460 more to buy the same basket of goods and services that they did in August of 2021, according to Ryan Sweet, who's a senior director of economic research at Moody's. Now, the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee is scheduled to meet again on September 20th and 21st, at which point they're almost certain to increase interest rates again, with the consensus view being that it will be another 0.75% increase. And that would put the rate at around 3.25%, which is the highest it's been since January of 2008, although not super high by historical standards. I crunched some numbers, and since 1955, the median federal funds rate is at just over 4%. So, Jay, what did you make of the latest CPI report, and what do you think the Fed's going to do, could do, should do, that sort of thing?
I've seen fire and I've seen rain, Mike. I think this is really sort of as predicted, right? I think to the extent you've had, again, the more volatile, particularly gas dropping, that hedged off what would have been a higher overall inflation view. But this is still a tremendous problem for most Americans, and it's the one that hits them in the face every week when you go to the grocery store. So I think it's still a tremendous issue. The Biden administration, I just again have to get into this as kind of the political malpractice piece of it. I mean, almost as bad as the whatever Supreme Leader Snoke speech in front of the Constitution Hall. The scheduling the bill signing for the day that this is going to come out, right? I just can't understand the, you know, wasn't there someone who would say, but geez, what if the numbers aren't good? No, it'll be fine. It'll be fine. Let's make sure we do it the same day. I mean, you're going to have this sort of, you know, split screen ads. If no one's made them yet, I mean, I'll make them for you. You know, President Biden signing the bill, James Taylor singing along to the crowd, and you know, showing the Dow Jones index dropping 1,000 points at the same time as the numbers come out. And again,
so you're making a connection here, and maybe you should make that connection a little more explicit to the listeners who might not have gotten that with the bill signing.
Oh, so I mean, there was the big White House lawn party, right? He had a big announcement. This was planned for a couple of weeks in advance that this is going to be the big celebration of defeating inflation. Yet no one, and again, this isn't a policy argument. This is a
optics, politics kind of thing.
Optics, yeah. Yes. This is a sure. General competence can no one play this game argument. Scheduling it for a date when they knew new inflation numbers would be coming out, without hedging against the possibility that maybe those numbers might not be good, and having this horrible optics on a bill that you know you've titled the Inflation Reduction Act, which in reality has absolutely zero to do with inflation, and then inviting aging boomer rock stars. It's just bizarre. It's like you can't even make this up, right?
Well, I think. To me,
that just strikes me. That strikes me as either he's getting terrible economic advice, and someone saying, "Listen, these numbers are definitely better. This is going to be a great day to do this because these numbers are going to come in great, and you'll be able to say, look at the great numbers." Or, you know, they're so overconfident there, or it's just a complete lack of hedging of, well, maybe we shouldn't do it on that day. Maybe we should do it the day after.
I think this is sort of indicative of how this is understandably viewed for certain folks in a certain right-wing bubble. And because honestly, this whole story, I think, is the kind of thing that is a Fox News, Wall Street Journal, right-wing media kind of, oh my God, look at how horrible these people are, how clueless, when honestly, to the most of the general public, number one, it's not even going to register, so the ads won't even really make sense. And number two, I would argue on policy grounds, the idea that the Inflation Reduction Act has anything to do with what we're experiencing right now is just, I think, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. So
I understand. But you also had Democrats a couple weeks ago, after they voted on the bill, before it was signed, before anything was effective, crowing about how the inflation has already gone down thanks to their efforts with the Inflation Reduction Act.
Sure. And that of course is, you know, absolutely ridiculous. Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree with that. But, you know,
my criticism, like I said, this is more just of the,
I get you. The optics, the politics.
How could you be this? I mean, if anyone would say, it's just this tremendous gamble, right?
See, I don't think so. I understand what you're saying, but I think this is only bad optics to people who dislike Biden in the first place and wouldn't consider voting for Democrats. So I don't think it's that big of a deal. I think it's like one of these issues that people in the super politically involved partisan classes focus on, but that regular people, nah, it's not going to matter.
I would say if you regular people who have 401ks or shop for groceries,
Let me make a distinction. I'm not saying that about inflation in general. Absolutely. You know, that's why I included that kind of real world kind of to give people a sense. But the idea of the connection between that and the Inflation Reduction Act, that's what I don't buy. That's the sort of thing that I think maybe might make sense to a certain sort of right of center partisan, but just is not going to connect with regular voters and also just is not supported by the facts. So that's kind of where I'm coming from with that. But let's move on to the Fed.
Let me put it this way. The facts would be, though, if Biden hadn't been saying, look at all of what I've done to reduce inflation so far, and made the statement last month, inflation is zero. That might be a bit, but it just, to me, it reinforces just an out of touch type situation where you've got a president who's saying inflation zero and you're going to the grocery store
it's not out of touch. You know, I think it's ridiculous.
Chicken thighs that you bought last year or this year are almost double what they were last year. So
I think the out of touch argument is just flat out wrong. This idea that politicians are out of touch and they don't know what's going on. I think he absolutely knows what's going on, and he's trying to spin it in a way that you may not agree with, but I think that doesn't follow that he's out of touch. I think a much more plausible explanation. He's like, well, yeah, these numbers are not what we'd like, but how can we at least make what's a not laughable argument that they're better? And you can, in fact, look at the headline numbers I pointed out is actually lower. Now, how many Americans are going to make that distinction between core inflation and energy? And maybe not so many. And so, again, I think this is one of these instances where the political classes see things one way and expect the rest of the less political universe to share that view. And so I don't think that's the case, though. So anyway,
I'm just saying as a practitioner,
sure.
Right? When you're talking about any political event, it's like a game of inches, you know, and everything is so fine tuned for every bit of political advantage, right? The size of the room, where you're doing it, who's where and what, the people who are standing behind the president, next to the president. All of those things, right, are so or ought to be, you know, so well thought out in advance, and yet this is, I don't know. I understand what you're saying.
Most people
look at this and they see again James Taylor singing, and they're just confused.
I don't think most people are even going to notice it. So that's why most people would have no idea that this even happened, in fact. So that's why I don't think it's that big of a deal, real. But on the policy side of things, I wanted to get.
But he's claiming this is the signature. This is the signature legislative piece of his presidency.
Yeah, but again, you can separate that from this when this event happened in Jamestown. And that's the kind of stuff, this insider baseball sort of stuff that matters a lot to people who have their minds made up already. But
that's why you have me on.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, absolutely. But when you shift from arguing about the insider baseball aspects to how this is going to, you know, play in Peoria, as it will, I think that's when we need to make that distinction. And that's why I'm saying that this is the sort of thing that played really big in the, you know, Republican fever swamps, but really is not that big of a deal in terms of optics. That's my argument. And I know you disagree, but,
No, my optics is, listen, these things are designed to play in Peoria. And if they don't, that's a problem.
Okay. Gotcha. Well, moving back to the policy aspect of things, what do you think the Fed is going to do? They're going to stick with their 0.75 or?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of what I thought.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what markets anticipated. And that's why you had the big Dow sell off. It's not, and again, it's not that, companies, the stock market hates inflation. What companies hate is the Fed's reaction to inflation.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I would say also on the Fed rate hike, I know some people are saying, well, they should make it a full point. I just want to point out that it typically takes, you know, this is a delayed reaction sort of thing. And so we have these two huge variables that are affecting prices, obviously Russia's war in Ukraine and COVID. And these things are, you know, not imponderables, but they could change significantly either way, right? For better or worse in the next 6 to 12 months. And so I think the Fed rightly doesn't want to overcorrect here and end up in a situation where they put too much of a brake on the economy and send us into an unnecessarily steep recession. And, you know, I mean, you take a look in China, they're easing lockdowns currently as new cases are going down. Ukraine is making significant progress in Russia. We'll talk about that later on. And we've got these new vaccine variants people are getting. And so, you know, it's not tough, I'm saying, to envision a much sort of more positive world economic picture by, say, early 2023. I'm not saying that's going to be the case, but I'm saying if you're the Fed, you have to kind of keep that in mind and saying, well, we want to make sure we don't put up, you know, stamp too hard on the brakes, basically.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You want to land the plane, not crash it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's one way to land. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, that's what we're trying to do. And it's a tricky feat one way or the other. And I think, let's put it this way. I think at this point we're heading for a rough landing, but not necessarily a crash, if you will.
Yeah, that's kind of how I see it too. So
I also want to throw out there. I just really hate James Taylor. Carry on.
Okay. So I guess I'm not a huge fan either, but I guess we could say that while you and I disagree on the political aspects of this, on the policy, we seem to be kind of on the same wavelength when it comes to this.
Oh, as far as the Fed goes, yeah,
as far as the Fed goes, absolutely. All right, okay. Well, let's move on to something a little.
And Mike, I would even add.
Okay, even add.
I think we might be, you know, eventually in a healthier place, because we've had these crazy low ahistorical interest rates for over a decade and a half almost now. If we started to get back to sort of more normalcy.
Yeah, I'm definitely with you there. I completely agree, because if you take a look at those interest rate over time charts, and it's really striking how we're pretty much at zero rates were kept for so long, and I think that was a mistake.
Contrary to what the modern monetarists would argue, but.
Yeah, well, you and I, like I said, you and I are not exactly in lockstep, but certainly there's not a whole lot of data.
We're pre-modern monetarists.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, let's move on to something a little bit different here. Well, very different, actually. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis this week chartered two planes to fly around 50 migrants from Texas to Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts, home or at least vacation home, to a number of prominent and wealthy progressives or liberals, including former President Barack Obama. Now, according to some media reports, the migrants were told that they were being transported to Boston, which is around 90 miles away, nearly a 3-hour drive, at least according to what Google Maps tells me, and the migrants had recently crossed from Texas into Texas from Mexico and were staying at a San Antonio shelter when they were apparently approached about the opportunity to go to Boston, where, according to some of the migrants, they were told they would be able to get expedited work papers. And this is part of a larger, I guess we call it, migrant relocation program that the Florida legislature appropriated $12 million for. The money reportedly for this coming out of interest from funds Florida received through the American Rescue Plan COVID State Fiscal Recovery Fund.
You can use it for anything.
Well, no, actually, this is an interesting twist.
This is interest, yes.
Because because the money's interest and not from that principal. It apparently doesn't fall under the legislation's spending restrictions. And so at least Florida are free to use this for whatever they want without technically violating a Florida law. So very clever there, however you feel about the wisdom of it as policy. A spokesman for DeSantis said that the transport was part of the state's relocation program to transport illegal immigrants to sanctuary destinations, and that states like Massachusetts, New York, and California will better facilitate the care of these individuals who they have invited into our country by incentivizing illegal immigration through their designation as sanctuary states and support for the Biden administration's open border policies. And this is itself part of a broader relocation effort on the part of some southern governors. For instance, Texas Governor Greg Abbott has been leading the way here. I think he bused nearly 8,000 migrants over time from his state to Washington, D.C., where of late Mayor Muriel Bowser declared a public health emergency in response to the inflow of migrants from Texas. And Abbott's most recent stunt, or I guess political protest, depending on how you want to look at it, was dropping off a group of 101 migrants outside of Vice President Harris's home this week, with Abbott tweeting, "We're sending migrants to our backyard to call on the Biden administration to do its job and secure the border." So, Jay, what do you think about this political stunt, reasonable political protest? I don't know. What's your take?
Oh, I mean, certainly political stunts, but a good one.
Explain.
Yeah, I mean, I think explain it. And this has, I think, focused the attention of the Biden administration that it needs to do something about this. And I think it's a good argument to point out these sanctuary states, sanctuary cities, that there is this tremendous hypocrisy of you have the little signs out in your front yard about love is love and science is real and you welcome everybody. But that's not really the case when it comes to this, when you have 50 illegal immigrants show up in Martha's Vineyard, or even 8,000 in New York.
Well, let me just stop you there, because it seems to me like that's actually they're following through on their slogans by taking care of these folks, doing the best they can. And so, I mean, it doesn't seem like these migrants are being shunned in any way, and it seems like they're getting a lot of support. So I guess I don't see the hypocrisy here, and maybe you can help me out with that. Before you move
The hypocrisy is the arguing that DeSantis and the Texas governor are horrible, terrible people for doing this, right? That this is something that's absolutely terrible, and the idea of claiming that all of a sudden the city of Chicago has a health emergency, or I believe they declared an emergency in Martha's Vineyard already, and we need more federal resources and so forth. When you look at the numbers of these like border towns, right? So I'm looking at this is from recent Wall Street Journal. Yuma, Arizona has a population of 100,000. There have been 250,000 migrants who have arrived in and around Yuma, Arizona in the last year. And no one is saying, oh my God, this is, it's Yuma, hey, deal with it. And it's also the sense of, well, you're not being humane enough in dealing with it. And I think it's also worth noting that the federal government has been relocating migrants throughout the year. They've just done so quietly.
I think
it's
okay. I see what you're saying. I certainly think you're right. You have a point in saying that there are certain states that are bearing a disproportionate burden, and they're and just relocating folks to places that might have better, more resources isn't necessarily, it might actually be a more humane thing to do. And so, yeah, on that.
Well, it's not only more humane. I do think there are a lot of northern politicians, non-border politicians, who are sort of been coasting on this virtue on the cheap type thing, right? To say, oh, can you believe how horrible Donald Trump is wanting to build a wall, and how terrible the Remain in Mexico policy was, and it's really good that Title 42 is ending. When they don't really have to face any actual consequences of it.
Sure,
if they do, they may start changing their tune and stop with the virtue signaling and saying, okay, now I guess this is a problem. When you have, again, Kamala Harris on national TV last week saying the border is secure. That's insane, and it's insulting.
I hear what you're saying, and maybe it's virtue signaling to a certain extent. It could be now if we may find out, right? Then that's the whole point. But I think it's not necessarily the case, because again, it seems like just because you declare emergency and need more funds doesn't mean that you're saying that, well, we don't want to take in these folks. And so I think you're maybe jumping to a conclusion here that's not entirely warranted. But I guess let me ask you this. So I'm not, for instance, Texas, Greg Abbott busing migrants to sanctuary cities, basically saying, hey, put up or shut up. I get that in a way. But what about this instance where it almost seems like kind of there's a sort of a hold my beer moment from Ron DeSantis saying, we're going to get migrants from a whole other state, right? I mean, this is weird, isn't it? Because
to me, that is a little weird of taking migrants from Texas.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm a Florida resident, I'm thinking, yeah, well, wait a second. So we're using state funds,
right,
to get
fly some of our own migrants.
Yeah. Exactly. And so that to me, and also that element of, you know, the reports that people were being told they would be taken to Boston and they'd have these sort of things happen that really weren't, they couldn't guarantee what happened. That to me, I want to make a distinction between the sort of stuff that Abbott is doing. Go ahead.
Do we know that for sure?
No, well, there are reports. That's why I'm saying. That's why I'm saying there are reports of that. But it seems to me that I can see somebody making a case, a reasonable case to me, about sort of not good intention necessarily, but what Abbott is doing makes sense and is not an awful thing. It's not just kind of a stunt that's using migrants. But what DeSantis has done here, I think, is just in a different category, I guess.
So your dispute is not so much with the fact that migrants were flown to Martha's Vineyard, but who flew them?
Well, not only who flew them, but what they were told if they were taken to someplace under false pretenses and given false promises. And there's a distinction I'm trying to make here between saying between having your question be what is in the best interest of these people who are here temporarily, and okay, maybe a better environment for them with more support is Massachusetts or Washington, D.C. That's one thing. But it's another thing to say, how can we use these people to make a political point? And that I have a big problem with. And there's some overlap between those things.
I would agree, but I think I don't see anything wrong with, if you want to say using, these people to make a political point, because there's a political point that needs to be made for the good of the nation, right? That this is a big problem that the Biden administration has been intensely avoiding, except when it steps in to discipline border control agents. So I think that's to me the issue. I think it's legitimate to say, listen, other places have better services, better able to handle this, put up or shut up. But I think it's a political stunt. And when I said it's a great political stunt, what I mean by that is, they're calling attention to what is a serious national issue that the Biden administration and most congressional Democrats have been simply sort of gaslighting the American public, saying no, there's no problem, the border's secure, and you see these images, and it's not, and 2 million apprehensions just this year. That's just the apprehensions, right?
Let me ask you this. Are you saying that misleading migrants, giving them kind of false promises about things, that's kind of like a reasonable price to pay to make this larger political message?
Well, one, there's an assumption in there that they were misled.
Right. Well, let's just work from that.
If they were misled, then no. Okay. No, that's not appropriate.
I wanted to make that clear. Okay.
Yeah, under any circumstances to mislead them.
So then is what you're saying that, hey, if it helps out these migrants, puts them in a better situation, and makes a strong political point, it's like a twofer. It's like a win-win kind of thing.
Exactly.
Okay, I can accept that. Sure, I can accept that. All right. Now, and, you know, I should point out kind of this is you mentioning the border crisis. The number of new asylum claims filed in U.S. immigration courts in 2022, over 156,000. That's still 4 months to go. If we go back, like, say, 2010, that total number for the whole year was 32,000. So, I mean, you're right. There's this huge surge. There's something like a backlog at total immigration cases of 1.8 million. I mean, asylum hearings, technically, they're supposed to be held within 45 days of an application. The current wait time, around 4.5 years. So, this is.
So that's what I'm saying. The whole asylum process, right, is de facto
broken. It's so totally broken.
Open borders. Yeah.
Well, and it's not open borders. And I think that's a misleading term that we shouldn't use, because we don't have anything like open borders. The situation would be very different. In fact, people who call for open borders say, no, we're nowhere close to that. And so I think that's a misleading and unfair term. Well, so now
when you can cross the border and stay for 4 years, what would you call it?
Open borders is a situation where you can cross, where anyone, as many people as possible, can cross the border. And that's just not the case. There are plenty of people who would like to cross the border and stay here indefinitely who aren't able to do that. So this is not open borders. Let's call it what it is. If you want to say they're more open than you'd like them to be, or they're not secure or closed, that's fine. But let's not use a term that makes it sound like anyone come over at any time and stay for as long as they want with no consequences, because that's just simply not accurate. That's what I'm saying.
Well, if I show up and I claim asylum, I can reasonably anticipate that I'll be here for 4 years.
If you can, and then, of course, there are some folks claiming asylum.
I don't have to prove my asylum case. I just have to claim it. And in 4 years, I'll get the opportunity to prove it or not.
Because the law says that's a right you have. And of course, the whole reason we have this broken asylum system is that we have immigration quotas that are, the open borders people would tell you, are just way too low, essentially. I mean,
no, fair enough. And you and I think would agree on the immigration quota issue, right? I would be okay with raising those numbers and allowing more legal immigration. But I think the sine qua non, before you can even do that, right, you have to have a secure border so that you can monitor those numbers and quotas. I don't think we have that. And I think the Biden administration has been pretty clear in communicating that it doesn't really want that.
Well, no, I would disagree, because one of the first things Joe Biden did after he became president was he asked Congress to put forward the U.S. Citizenship Act of 2021. And that was actually comprehensive migration reform. Now, a lot of Republicans, most Republicans, maybe almost all Republicans in Congress, didn't get behind it, because it also called for a path to citizenship for a whole bunch of people in this country without documentation. But it also called for things like dramatically increasing immigration court capacity and more border security, more high tech stuff going on. So it's not like
but when we talked about this back when he talked about it, the issue there is that's exactly the type of call to say, hey, please come here, because I'm proposing that you all be made citizens, regardless of whether you come into the country legally or illegally. And with the technology piece, again, that always seems perplexing to me. If you're looking at our legal system, which says once you set foot here, you can claim asylum, and then you're, as you pointed out, here for, you know, on average about 4 years or so, assuming you show up for your hearing. You know, what good is the high tech piece do other than, well, here's someone else? I suppose it keeps a better count, maybe, but it certainly doesn't secure the border. So Biden saying he's, you know, ending the Remain in Mexico policy. Well, all right, that certainly seems to be an invitation to please come on in. The Title 42 stuff, again, Biden caught a break in that the court
prevented him from changing that.
Right. If that had happened, I think he'd even be in a deeper problem. And just statements generally that look, I mean, Trump's position, say what you will about Donald Trump, he was pretty clear about how he felt about immigration. And Biden made clear that he would be sort of the opposite of that. So I think that's what I say when you're sending a message that please come on in. And the idea that, look, that these waves of increases coincided with Biden taking office. And again, early on, we had Secretary Mayorkas assuring everyone, well, no, look, you racist morons. This is all just seasonal, and this happens all the time, when that's simply not the case. So,
yeah, I mean, I guess I don't know if we differ on this. I mean, I feel like I certainly am a proponent of the fundamental aims, ideals of the Biden administration's approach to this, which would be much more openness than we have now. And, you know, I certainly agree that reasonable people can criticize elements of that U.S. Citizenship Act. But my point in bringing it up was that it's not like the Biden administration thinks that things can't be made a whole lot better. And I think anyone who says that, you know, there's not that our asylum system is not completely broken has their head just way, way deep in the sand on this. And so, yeah, this idea that the border is, well, I guess.
But then why not reinstitute Remain in Mexico? Or why have Kamala Harris, who's her, you know, that's part of her portfolio, right, is border issues, say these ludicrous things about the border secure?
I guess that gets into this. Again, it gets into this issue. What do we mean by secure? I mean, if you, as you point out, if we have,
I mean, stop people from coming across who aren't supposed to come across.
But I mean, your point being that, just saying that if you step foot in this country, right, and you can make and you want to make an asylum claim, the law says you're allowed to make that asylum claim. And if I understand your point, is that, well, we need a system so that people don't have the opportunity to step foot in this country.
Yes.
Okay.
Without going through if you say, hey, I'd like to seek asylum, then you go to the immigration office at the border and say, I'd like to have request asylum. Not that you come into the country and then you are released into the country for years at a time. While those hearings are processed, and as you know, I mean, look, these asylum claims in something like 90% of the cases, probably more than that, these migrants would not qualify for asylum.
Believe it or not, Jay, I thought that too, but I seem to recall, and I'll maybe try to double check on this, but actually it's a lot higher than just 10%. And maybe that was a difference in administration, because under the Trump administration, I believe they were interpreting things in a slightly different way than under the Biden administration. So, but it's not actually.
Okay. But, all right,
but no, but,
then,
but I mean, that's the reasonable, you can disagree. You can, it's not as clear cut necessarily as what constitutes a valid asylum claim. If you're looking to reject people, it's a lot easier to do that than if you're looking to accept them.
Right. Which brings me back to, this is an issue of the Biden administration's making.
Sure. I see what you're saying.
If you're going to say, we're changing the criteria now for asylum, and now it's even easier to get asylum. Yep. And hopefully, once we get a bigger majority or bust the filibuster, we'll make everyone citizens. And hey, the city of New York says you can vote in its elections. Yeah, I how do you not read that as an invitation?
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. I would have preferred to have seen the Biden administration just come out and say, listen, because of our more, if you will, opening, welcoming, humanitarian, whatever you want to call it, attitude, we need to dramatically increase, we need to dramatically increase the capacity of our immigration courts and to submit a standalone legislation on that and just say to Republicans, hey, you know, are you going to vote against this? It has nothing to do with, but they didn't do that because.
And not only that, I would say America needs workers.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
you know, to me, that's, you know, and that's always been a big immigration issue is we, you know, look, we need the help.
I would
be happy of getting behind something of, again, a system where people come in saying, hey, the economy in my country sucks. I have no economic opportunities. I'd like to come to America and work. And we say, okay, here's your work permit. And you know what? If you play by the rules, and here's a path to citizenship in the future. I would be all for that sort of solution.
Yeah, me too. And yeah, I wind up.
But no, I'm not for a retroactive. We're going to let all the people who came illegally jump ahead of the guy who came in. And I should say that's the way immigration happens for a lot of people. I'll go back to my buddy at the Thai restaurant. Right, we should have him on sometime. I'm all for that. But if we don't have a secure border, where we essentially stop people before they come in, then I think that makes that kind of system impossible.
Yeah, I think those are reasonable points. Certainly, you and I think could probably figure out a perfectly fine immigration policy. They just let us kind of bang it out in a couple of weeks or something like that. But one thing I did want to point out is that folks who are waiting to have their asylum hearing actually can apply for authorization to work 150 days after filing for asylum. But then they have to renew those documents every 2 years. And it turns out you would think, well, 2 years, they should have their hearing. That's the problem, right? Of course. And the other thing I wanted to point out is that since around 2009, we've averaged around 1 million green cards issued per year. And to me, I would think a sane immigration policy would be saying, well, you know, starting with maybe doubling that and also maybe including a resettlement program so that a small number of states on the southern border aren't unfairly burdened with that. So, there we go. Okay.
All right.
I think we have time for one more story this week, so let's do that. This week, South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham introduced the Protecting Pain-Capable Unborn Children from Late-Term Abortions Act. There's no good acronym for that.
That rolls off the tongue.
You know, it's pretty awful, isn't it? But what the legislation would do would be to...
What's the acronym for that?
It's the... PPCUCFTAAA.
There you go.
Yeah, exactly. So what it would do, it would ban abortions across the country after 15 weeks with exceptions for rape, incest, or risks to the life or physical health of the mother, but it would leave in place any more restrictive state bans. And according to the press release from Senator Graham's office that came after he introduced it, 15 weeks was chosen because it's the point at which a fetus or unborn child, in the phrasing of the legislation, can feel pain and would also put the U.S. in line with many other modern societies, with Graham pointing out that 47 out of 50 European countries limit elective abortion prior to 15 weeks of gestation. And when asked about Graham's bill, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said most Republican senators prefer this be handled at the state level. And so, Jay, I think McConnell's reaction is telling. I thought, though, we could consider this on two levels. Both the first, the substance, what we think of the legislation itself as legislation, and then as well, I think what Mitch McConnell is much more concerned with, the politics. So let's start with the substance. Do you think this is a good policy for Congress, Jay?
For Congress, no. I think if various states want to enact it, more power to them, right? I think that it's sort of consistent with what Mississippi's, you know, the Mississippi statute that was upheld in Dobbs. And as you point out, it's pretty consistent with our European betters. So I think it's, you know, from that standpoint, I think it's fine. But I think McConnell's exactly right that this is not should not be a federal issue. Now, when we get into the politics, there's another kind of interesting, and I think McConnell's been pretty clear that he said he's not planning to bring this bill to the floor or to push it. And clearly Chuck Schumer is not going to be pushing for a vote on it. So I think it's, you know, it falls into that sort of political stunt type thing. So that said, I mean, I see it both ways, right? It's one of those things that, again, it's something, it's a free pass because you know, it's never going to pass. It's never going to get a vote. It's probably unconstitutional. So that bugs me that filing the probably unconstitutional bill.
Really? I think it's entirely constitutionally acceptable, but that's okay. a whole other issue. I would say it's almost certainly constitutionally okay, but you know, it seems to me that if you just took out the part about leaving in place more restrictive state bans, it would almost be something I could support, because I think 15 weeks, if you take a look, you know, I think it kind of, I'd maybe like a little bit longer, more choice, but in terms of a reasonable compromise, there's a lot to be said for that. Yeah. In fact, there's a lot that Chief Justice Roberts said in his dissent in Dobbs, right, on that. So,
and I think if you did a poll, I mean, I think you would probably end up somewhere around, right? I mean, I think that's what the poll numbers tend to show, yeah, that most Americans support some right to abortion early in the pregnancy, but favor restrictions later on. And it's just a matter of finding where exactly that number is. And
yeah,
15 weeks is probably, you know,
I mean, personally,
I think between somewhere between 12 and 15 weeks is where most people are going to come down on that.
Well, I think a lot of people come down later. I mean, in terms of, I would argue, still
over 20, I should have said,
for the viability kind of point, which is further out. But I mean, I think, again, in terms of trying to find a compromise, 15 weeks is, you know, for a lot of reasons makes sense. But regardless of, you know, the policy aspect, politically, it seems like a weird thing. I guess Graham thinks it's going to give Republican voters an issue to get excited about, just saying, if only we can get a few more, you know, a few more seats in Congress, we can do this. But of course, number one, there's no way it gets 60 votes in the Senate, because there aren't going to be 60 Republicans in the Senate. And even if it did, of course, President Biden would veto it immediately. So I guess it just seems to me to be a political miscalculation on Lindsey Graham's part, and I wanted to get your take on that from the Republican side.
Well, so I'm still trying to do the calculation,
okay,
right? I can't decide yet if it's brilliant or incredibly stupid. So the line from Spinal Tap, it's a thin line between genius and stupidity.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, Republicans have been subject since Dobbs to the criticism of, you know, you want to ban all abortions, they're going to ban. And already I think Biden and the Democrats have been incredibly disingenuous in saying, proposing a nationwide ban. Well, a nationwide ban after 15 weeks. And there's a significant difference than just saying nationwide ban. But setting that aside, Republicans have been vulnerable to the argument that, well, you know, they're just, you know, getting rid of abortion rights altogether. And there's almost like sort of this race to the bottom, right, of in certain pro-life circles about who can be the most restrictive. This puts out sort of the, hey, look, here would be the general Republican proposal, right, that is just kind of a model bill, if you will, right, that, look, here's something that we could live with. So as a negotiating tactic, right, that then you can say, well, look, don't you think? And look, it works on you, right? Hey, well, what's so unreasonable about 15 weeks?
But it only works on me if you got the key component of more restrictive states. Exactly. Yeah. So that's a pretty big part of it, right?
But the idea of the model bill of what's the general default Republican proposal? And you say 15 weeks with exceptions for rape, incest, health of the mother. I think most of the country would look at that. And other, again, there's going to be certainly the stalwarts on either side and say, yeah, that strikes me as a not unreasonable compromise. Am I crazy about it? No. Do I love it? No. But again, it's you know, when you look at that, well, that's how most of Europe does it. And, you know, so it's probably OK. So I in that way, I think it seems to be smart politics, right? That you're providing, again, sort of a position paper almost, right, rather than actual legislation. Again, the issue that bugs me a little bit is I do think there is a Commerce Clause issue as to whether Congress can enact a nationwide abortion, whatever, ban, protection, what have you. So that's on the one hand. The other hand, where you say, is it stupidity? My sense, if I'm a Republican going into the midterms, what I want to focus on more than anything is the economy and inflation.
Yeah.
And throwing this out there and giving the Democrats the ammunition to run around saying Republicans have proposed a nationwide ban on abortion, true or not, isn't helpful. So yeah. I think, yeah, Lindsey Graham is taking the risk that, you know, you can explain this and you get to that second level of the conversation where you say, no, it's not actually a nationwide ban. What it is simply a 15-week ban, which is something that most people could, you know, live with.
I think in the end, Mitch McConnell is pretty strategically smart, and I think his position tells you kind of where you should fall, probably be inclined to fall on this. And it's more the we're not going to get to that second level sort of thing. And it's something that he and I think a number of other members in the Senate leadership just wished that Lindsey Graham had kept his mouth shut about, essentially, at least until after the midterms.
Yeah, I think so. And again, I don't know enough about it.
But in the end,
yeah, because if you have candidates out there, right, and it's going to vary from district to district and state to state, where someone says, well, what do you think about Lindsey Graham's bill? And it opens them up to say, well, you know what, I'm with Mitch. I think this should be handled state by state. But to me, 15 weeks with exceptions for rape and life of the mother and all that seems pretty reasonable. That could be helpful in certain districts.
But I think, like, I mean, if you're Mitch McConnell, you don't care about certain districts, you care about the Senate. And so you get a situation where in Georgia, right, Herschel Walker is in a tight battle with Warnock for that seat, says, well, you know, I think it should be left up to the states, but I would support this. And it's like, well, that's you missed the point here of how to respond to this. I think it's exactly what we are hoping on the Democratic side that you would say, of course. And so that's why in the end, I think that it's not going to be a beneficial politically, certainly, and it's not going to happen as a matter of policy.
Yeah. No, I think it's a risky play. It may turn out to be brilliant. It may turn out to be incredibly stupid. I haven't made up my mind yet.
Okay. All right. Well,
but other than I'm just on the federalism type idea look, there our argument has been and should be that this is not a certainly not an issue for a court to make law on, but secondly, not particularly one that the federal government ought to make law, and it's better to be handled by states.
Right. And so you can make the kind of hypocrisy arguments that, well, you're all for federalism, Lindsey Graham, except on this, I guess, where.
No, again, how much does that as we're talking about the average voter about Lindsey Graham's being hypocritical about federalism.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's not going to necessarily
got
drive
you there.
People
yeah.
To the polls.
No, not hardly. Yeah. Not hardly. All right. Well, one thing before we go, I hope everyone, you are already listening to When the People Decide. And if you're not, seriously, stop right now. Type When the People Decide into your podcast search app or, I don't know, web browser if you're old school about it, and put it in your queue. It is a fantastic podcast about democracy. It's as grassrootsy as grassroots gets. The people behind citizen initiatives and the people who want to stop them. You know, it comes out of the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State. They are smart, interesting people. Big fans of them and their work. And you'll just hear great stories about regular people doing some pretty amazing things. Good stuff. I really enjoy listening to it. So make room in your podcast list for When the People Decide. You'll be glad you did. I know that I am. All right. So let's see. Do we have new supporters to thank? We do. Well, we have Jen to thank.
Wow.
Jen is actually a longtime supporter who recently increased her support for the show. That's a thing you can do, support.
As I often say, a triumph of hope over experience.
There you go. So thank you, Jen, so much. We really do appreciate it. And if you're not already a supporter of the show, we hope you'll consider becoming one because you're the reason we're able to keep the show going. And when you become a supporter, you get all sorts of good stuff. You get ad-free versions of everything, as well as our supporter-exclusive midweek show where we try to look at kind of larger issues. This week, Jane and I are going to be talking about the bigger picture, looking at Russia, China, and the United States, Biden's cancer moonshot, a whole bunch of states banning gas-powered vehicles. I think Jay's going to have some stuff to say about that. All kinds of cool stuff.
Indeed.
Yeah. So anyway, and also there's our supporter-exclusive Politics Guys Discord group, which is always a lot of fun, and even Politics Guys gear and other benefits at different levels of support. To check it out, go to patreon.com/politicsguys. If you'd like to support us on Venmo or at Politics Guys, you can also support the show through PayPal, and all of our support links are in the show notes as well as at politicsguys.com/support. And if you'd like to get that midweek supporter show, but you're just not in a position where you can financially support us, not a problem. Send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will get that set up for you. Whether you're a supporter or not, it really does help if you can subscribe, rate and review us on the podcast app you happen to be using, and share episodes on social media. And if you'd like to get in touch with us for any reason, you can reach us at mail@politicsguys.com. There's also Facebook and Twitter. You'll find links in our show notes and, of course, our Discord group for supporters. Finally, a special thanks to our most excellent executive producers, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Andre Masker, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby. We'll be back with a new episode for you next week. We hope you join us.